teachers in Oklahoma fed up and not taking it anymore.
About 4 years ago is when I noticed that our school district couldn't hide it anymore, that we were in a crisis mode.
Confrontations between teachers and legislatures across the country and the politics that helped drive the crisis.
The cumulative effect represents an education agenda that is right of center, that looks to shrink the size of education budgets, and some would go so far as to say deprofessionalizes teaching.
And the dilemma of raising children behind bars.
What's more humane, to keep a child with his mother and foster that connection, or to allow a kid in a prison, but eventually they become aware of their surroundings?
This is the Takeaway Podcast for Friday, April 6th, 2018.
It's getting hard to breathe, and I know you feel like dying, but we're gonna bring Oklahoma to its knees and move mountains.
We're not leaving. We're not leaving.
Let them hear it.
For me and my friends that have been through this with me, we love to teach or we wouldn't be doing it. I think it's just taken some of the joy away from teaching.
This is The Takeaway. I'm Todd Zwillick. And for a week now, educators in Oklahoma have been on strike. It's a story that's been playing out across the nation, of course. Oklahoma all the way to West Virginia, Kentucky, back to Arizona, potentially other states as well. And in some cases, teachers are asking for better pay, but in Oklahoma, they're also asking for more funding for schools. We start today with the story of one Sooner teacher who's struggling to hold on to her nearly 30-year career.
My name is Lily Lyon, and I'm a teacher at Moore Public Schools in Moore, Oklahoma. I teach at the junior high level, but I teach high school Spanish for credit, and also I teach English as a second language. I've been there 10 years. I came here from Indiana, so I've worked at other school districts before this. First thing, of course, when I got here from Indiana, I took a $10,000 cut in pay, but I just sort of figured that would slowly increase. It was okay. But the school itself was marvelous. We had amazing programs for the kids. We had weightlifting. We had tech ed, where they would go out and build things, robots using computers. I don't know the ins and outs of it, but it was awesome. We had robotics. We had foods, economics, home economics, a lot of extra programs, an amazing art program with 3D art, 2D art, full-time art teacher. We also had excellent teachers. The school was just flooded with good teachers. Every year we would get funding for our department and we would share it. We would divvy it up and we would have money to buy supplies, to buy science lab supplies for the labs, new equipment, new technology support, and that kind of thing. We also had field trips back then. About 4 years ago is when I noticed that our school district couldn't hide it anymore, that we were in a crisis mode. One program at a time would be cut, and all of a sudden we didn't have tech ed anymore, we didn't have weightlifting, we didn't have foods, home economics, our art teacher had to be shared between two schools, we lost the funding for robotics, after school clubs. The teachers now have to do those on their own time. They don't get a stipend, and they don't get any money for supplies. And we lost teachers left and right, good teachers. They moved to Texas. they let us know how much they got there. It's like $17,000 more a year. We also lost teachers to other professions. That's what surprised me the most. They've gone to court reporting for the court. They are working at the hospitals. One went into nursing. One is now going into FBI instead of teaching. One is thinking of going into the billing department in a medical field. We're losing our teachers because they just don't make enough money. Last semester, I just started asking my coworkers, does anybody else make the exact same amount you made 10 years ago? And they go, yeah, Lily, we haven't had a raise in 10 years. Interesting that nothing else stayed the same. My, you know, homeowner's insurance didn't stay the same. My insurance for my car didn't stay the same. But for me, I worked two jobs after school, and I got a roommate to help with my expenses. We certainly were happy that they passed at least a small teacher raise. It sounds like a lot of money, $6,000. That's not a lot of money over 10 years. That's about $800 a year, if my math is correct. So it's not that much, but that's not what we're the most upset about. It's that funding per student. And that's why the teachers walked out Monday, because we didn't get what we wanted per student. We've got textbooks that are falling apart. I have students sharing textbooks. I have students saying to me, Maestra, we don't have page 405 and 406. It's been torn out. And, you know, I think they've been sending pictures all over Facebook of the classrooms, and it's kind of sad. My class sizes were 22, 25, just wonderful sizes for teaching a language. 2 or 3 years ago when we had the recession, economic downturn, and now they're 31, 32, 33, and we're packed in there like sardines. And, you know, we get sent away for professional development, and we're taught all these wonderful things where you get in centers and you move around the room and you do all this interactive stuff. But when you pack 33 kids in a room, they can't move. They are in their chair for 55 minutes. If you have anybody moving, you're going to have chaos in the room. So everybody has to sit 55 minutes. They don't like it. I'm not sure they know what they're missing. My granddaughter's 12, and she was watching me write these things down of the clubs and things we used to have in the classes. She goes, Grandma, what is that? I didn't know we had weightlifting and tech ed. And I said, we don't anymore. We used to have it.
Lily Lyon has taught at Moore Public Schools in Moore, Oklahoma for 10 years. And we've been hearing from you.
My name is Emily Masters. I'm a library media specialist at the elementary level in Oklahoma City. And instead of being in my library this last week, I have been at the Capitol. I'm searching for the funding that was cut from the education budget in Oklahoma over the last 10 years. $200 million annually is missing from our education budget, and it's showing. We have textbooks that are so old that the last president in them is Bill Clinton. We don't have enough chairs for our students. We aren't able to give them the education they deserve because we don't have the funds to give them the resources they need.
My name is Daniel Young. I teach English at Putnam City High School in Oklahoma City, Oklahoma. This week, my colleagues and I have walked out of our classrooms because learning has become seriously interrupted in this state due to a decade's worth of budget cuts. And this has resulted in hundreds of cut positions despite tens of thousands of new students. It's resulted in fewer electives and fewer AP courses, and it's resulted in larger class sizes. In fact, more than 90 districts in Oklahoma have turned to four-day school weeks in order to save money, and we're committed to staying out of our classrooms until Oklahoma commits to properly funding education in the years to come and restoring those cuts.
It's Jill in California. I went to an elementary school 30 years ago that's now a charter, which means that not just any kid can go to it. California hasn't properly funded schools, and the result is that some children are simply locked out of a decent education.
Aloha, this is Pete calling from the colony of Hawaii. Here in Hawaii, it's impossible to buy a home on a teacher's salary, so it's not unusual for teachers to require second jobs and careers, which compromises a teacher's ability to be fully present and engaged. You know, some teachers have returned to jobs like bartending for financial survival. That's not worth the debt required to become a teacher in the first place.
This is Hannah calling from Portland, Oregon. I'm not a teacher, but I'm a PTA board member in Portland, Oregon. Our PTA routinely pays for two full-time teachers each school year. This year, that's over $270,000 of parent-raised funds going to teaching staff, not quote-unquote extras such as library, reading specialists, and PE. This brings some of our teacher-to-student ratios down, though we'll still have 30 to 32 students in many elementary school classrooms next year.
Well, as the confrontation over education budgets plays out in Oklahoma and Kentucky and Arizona and West Virginia, let's take a look now at the big picture of education funding across the country. Michael Leachman is director of state fiscal research at the Center on Budget and Policy Priorities, and he spends his time looking at how states are funding their schools.
A decade ago, the Great Recession hit, and after that, state revenues really fell off a table. Most states cut funding for schools, and in a lot of states, significantly, when that recession hit. Now, over the last several years, the economy's gradually improved, and most states have been able to rebuild. But there's a group of states that haven't, and most of those states dug their hole deeper after the recession hit by cutting taxes, especially for the wealthy and corporations, and that has made it especially difficult for those states to recover. And so you see this group of states where school funding is still significantly below where it was before the recession hit a decade ago.
Now, some examples of these states where the hole's gotten even deeper in your view.
Arizona, Mississippi, Oklahoma, North Carolina. Kansas started to reverse course last year, but still has a way to go. Idaho.
Now, Arizona and Oklahoma were two of the first states on your list. These are some of the very states where we're seeing teachers protest or threaten to strike now because of education funding and their salaries.
Yes, that's exactly right. And there's a direct connection between these tax cuts for the wealthy over the last 10, 12 years and the teacher crises, the teacher pay crises that we're seeing play out in these states. Oklahoma, for example, cuts personal income tax rates starting about 12 years ago and then continuing even after the recession hit, even after they had a big budget shortfall, they were still cutting income taxes. And you see that playing out in the resources that are available to fund schools and other state services. So general fund resources in states, that's the fund that supports schools and other major state services. General fund resources in Oklahoma are down 35%. And so you just have less money available. And because teacher pay is the biggest part of school budgets, it's hard to have that reduced level of resources not have an effect on your ability to pay for qualified teachers. Now you have in Oklahoma and Arizona and some of these other states, you have major teacher shortages where they're having a really hard time getting qualified teachers into the classroom.
Now, this isn't all about cuts everywhere. According to your data, 29 states have cut education since the recession in 2008, but 21 states have raised their education spending per child back to the same level or where it was in 2008. But does that mean that education is getting adequate funding in all of those 21 states?
No, this is a comparison to the level in place in 2008. It doesn't mean that kids in schools across those states are getting the resources that they need. In fact, there are lawsuits pending in some of these states that argue that at least some communities aren't getting the resources that the state constitution requires.
So, Michael, talk a little bit more, if you would, about the impact on students. What do the data say about class size, about the quality of education, test scores, or other empirical data that show how these budget impacts are affecting the kids?
That's the question, right? matters not only for those kids, but for our future together, our the future economy, our future, the future health of our country. We know what works, basically, in education. What is most important is that kids have high-quality teachers and that they get to spend as much time as possible with those teachers. And so when you're cutting funding for schools, it makes it harder for you to hold and attract high-quality teachers. It also, if you're cutting taxes so that you don't have the resources available for schools, it also makes it harder to have smaller class sizes, which is especially important in the younger grades. It makes it harder to extend learning time. You know, in a significant number of districts in Oklahoma, they're at four-day school weeks. It just makes it harder to do the sorts of things that help kids to succeed. And again, that is really important for all of us and our future as a country.
So, Michael, where does this go? I know you don't quite have a crystal ball as much as you have economic data, but we've seen strikes in West Virginia, Oklahoma, threatened strikes elsewhere. We've talked about that. These are not the only states that have faced deep cuts. There are lawsuits in some places. As a country, where are we headed with this funding and with the quality of our education?
Well, I'm hopeful. You know, even in these very conservative places, you're seeing lawmakers reverse course and start to recognize that their education systems are at risk, at serious risk, and they need to take a different course. In other states, that's already been recognized, and fortunately, they are making investments. I'm hopeful about the direction. I'm still worried about some of these states. North Carolina is an example of a state that cut income taxes for the well-off more recently than some of these other states. And so the impact hasn't been felt fully yet. But in 2 years, the state's already forecasting a $1 billion shortfall. And this is in a state that's already cut its support for schools significantly over the last 10 years. So I'm worried about that state. I'm worried about Mississippi. Some of these other states where this notion that tax cuts are the way to economic growth, which the research doesn't show that that is an effective approach. What we need is to get back to the basics and invest in our kids and our communities.
Michael Leachman with the Center on Budget and Policy Priorities, thanks for being with us.
Thank you. I appreciate the chance. Nice talking to you.
You know, whether it's tax cuts or school budget fights or strikes, what drives all of it in the end is politics. And we want to take a look now at how politics fits into this picture of education funding across the United States. Eric Hauck is here. He's Associate Professor of Educational Leadership and Policy at the School of Education at UNC Chapel Hill. Eric, welcome to The Takeaway.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Well, Eric, we just heard how the recession of 2008 and 2009 drove down state budgets across the country. That was pretty easy to understand. And it was also the beginning of the Tea Party movement that had a lot of drivers itself, and government spending was one of them.
That's correct. So there is a political movement towards cost minimization at the state and local level, which looks at cutting costs. And one of the biggest drivers of budgets at the state and local level is usually education and public education. When that political philosophy gets crossed with some legitimate academic questions about how we're investing in schools and if we're investing in policies and measures that give us the biggest gains in student achievement or close academic achievement gaps between different groups of students, it's almost a perfect storm of political philosophy and academic research that gave a lot of encouragement and impetus towards movements and in the political realm to minimize spending.
So let's not dance around it, Eric. The states that have cut their budgets, West Virginia, Mississippi, Kentucky, Alabama, we can go on with the list. Are they all Republican? Is that part of what's going on here as the party has gotten even more conservative?
It is. There's questions about the efficiency and efficacy of public education systems. A lot of this can be driven through legislation through the American Legislative Exchange Council, or ALEC. This model legislation goes out to legislators in majority Republican states, and they pick that up and are able to run that through the legislative process with very little opposition.
Now, talk a little bit more about ALEC and how you think they're helping to drive this process.
Sure. Well, ALEC is a tremendous resource in the sense that they will work to craft legislation, a model legislation, that can be easily introduced and taken up in legislatures across a variety of state contexts. And so what that agenda becomes, making government smaller, trying to eliminate policies that folks at ALEC think are wasteful or don't contribute to student learning, this legislation can be crafted and deployed across a number of states. The political realities of not just that these states are Republican, but how Republican they are. So a lot of states have veto-proof majorities in the chambers, and they're able to move this legislation through relatively quickly with minimal opposition.
Now, you're describing sort of a cookie-cutter legislative approach, right? I mean, every state is different, but ALEC formulates a policy, formulates a sample bill, sends it out to the legislature, I don't know, let's say in Oklahoma, if you like, or Michigan or Arizona. I'm just picking those out of the air, and says, hey, want to cut education spending? Here's a great way to do it. And they sort of send the cookie-cutter over there.
Yeah, I think the only caveat I'd have to that is I'm not sure that the top line of the email says, here's a bill to cut education spending, right?
Right.
The top line of the email would say something like, we don't think that teachers with master's degrees are effective and maybe shouldn't be paid for having those degrees. Here's a bill that eliminates that. Or we think that students don't have enough choice and options and there should be public support for those choice options, and here's a bill that addresses that. So it does get wrapped around legitimate policy issues and questions, but the cumulative effect represents an education agenda that is right of center, that looks to shrink the size of education budgets, and some would go so far as to say deprofessionalizes teaching.
Now, Eric, you work in North Carolina primarily, but you're talking to me today from Tulsa, Oklahoma, right?
Yes, absolutely. I'm here at an academic conference on school finance that's been planned for a while. We had no idea that we were going to begin our conference in a state that was having a teacher walkout.
Now, Eric, how important are unions in situations like this? We saw the teachers union in West Virginia help to organize pretty heavily. Oklahoma teachers have a union, too, that has collective bargaining, but I hear they're relatively weak.
That's correct. And from what I've heard, again, this isn't a national research. This is actually talking to folks who are doing this, is that the Education Association of Oklahoma wasn't really part of the impetus of this, although they have come around to become strong supporters of the movement. That this was really, as some folks tell the story, a couple of teachers on Facebook organizing their peers and pulling something together just because they were very frustrated. Another aspect of this legislative push in a lot of Republican legislatures has been efforts to minimize the role of professional education associations or unions across states. So, for example, legislation that doesn't allow state education associations to draft membership dues out of the members' paychecks, thereby creating an additional barrier for members to have to write a check or to create some other way to draft out their dues, has resulted in a significant decreases in North Carolina in membership, for example, in the North Carolina Association of Educators. So at the same time that unions and professional associations have been a little bit defanged by this legislative action, you still see this desire for change and voice among teachers, and in some ways they're getting the ball rolling without the organizational impetus from an organization such as a professional association or union.
So, Eric, take a second with me, if you would, and look across the broad arc of the politics of this funding and what's happening now. We went back to 2008 and 2009, and then all of the efforts, in some cases, to rebuild education funding, in many other cases, to cut it. And now we're seeing these reactions, these strikes, West Virginia, Oklahoma, possibly Arizona, maybe other states. When you look across that 10-year span, what do you see?
I think what you see over the 10-year span is the culmination of a lot of small education policies that are leading to a culminating point for the lived experiences of educators that feels unsustainable and disrespectful. And as a result of that, financial pressure, some of the rhetoric that gets these bills passed can be a little rough on teachers and educators. Just a growing sense that we are organized enough. We don't have to take this in the same way that we've maybe taken it in the past. I think seeing resources come back into state coffers and watching how legislators treat those new resources that is not bringing funding up to match 2008, 2010 levels is something that teachers are paying attention to. You know, they might have given legislators a pass during the recession because everybody was tightening their belts. But now that money's flowing back in, to see that money not going to rebuild education budgets really gives the lie to some of the rhetoric about frugality that was coming from legislative houses.
Eric Houck with the School of Education at UNC Chapel Hill. Professor Houck, thank you so much.
Thank you. It was good to talk to you.
Got a comment for the show? Hit us up on our Facebook page, tweet us at The Takeaway, or leave us a voicemail at 877-8-MY-TAKE. Your ideas and takes are a huge part of who we are. Let us know what you're thinking about. This is The Takeaway.
In the United States, when a woman gives birth in prison, she's quickly separated from her child. Not so in Mexico. There, you might see children as old as six still living with their incarcerated mothers or even attending school. Those are children in class in the Santa Marta Aquitatla Maximum Security Prison on the outskirts of Mexico City. Now, conditions for kids vary widely between prisons in Mexico, but the Mexico Human Rights Commission says that more children than ever are living behind bars with their mothers in Mexico, around 600 in 2016, according to estimates. Jasmine Garst is a correspondent for the Across Women's Lives Project on Public Radio International. She's been looking into the prisons in Mexico, talking with mothers raising their children there and asking what's best for the kids.
Basically, if you give birth when you are in prison, you will get to keep your baby until, it used to be until the age of six. A new law says it's until the age of three, but it isn't retroactive. So there's a whole generation of kids that are going to be staying in prison until they're 6 years old. And this is actually pretty standard around the world. In fact, the U.S. is kind of an outlier when it comes to allowing mothers to stay with their babies in prison nurseries. It's not allowed here in the U.S. for the most part. In the rest of the world, this is pretty standard.
Well, you followed two families and their experiences with this system. Introduce us to Nancy.
Sure. Nancy Polanco Najera is a 34-year-old woman. She's been in prison since she was 19 years old. When she was 19, she got sentenced to 40 years in prison. So Nancy Polanco has a 4-year-old child. His name is Alexis. She's raising him in the prison. And she is worried about how, you know, by the time a kid is 4 years old, he or she starts to kind of figure out where they live and where they are, and she's worried about that.
He'll be watching TV, the news, and they'll talk about someone who's being sent to Santa Marta prison, and he'll say, we live there, and he'll ask, why do we live here?
And that's kind of, you know, that's kind of like the big debate. What's more humane, to keep a child with his mother and foster that connection, or to, you know, allow a kid in a prison, but eventually they become aware of their surroundings?
I mean, Jasmine, Nancy, of course, doesn't want to be separated from her child. At the same time, she's living with the inevitable idea that a young 4-year-old is starting to realize that he's behind bars.
Yeah, not only that, he's in 2 years, he's going to have to leave by law. And she's kind of trying to prepare him for this. And what's really heartbreaking about Nancy's story is that her whole family is incarcerated. She's in there with her mother, with her sister, with her boyfriend. Her father was incarcerated and he passed away. This was that, you know, they're accused of running an organized crime family. And like a lot of organized crime, it's a family affair. And there is no one to take her child on the outside.
Well, with no family on the outside, in fact, with most of the family on the inside or passed away, as you mentioned, what's in store for Alexis in a couple of short years?
It's very haphazard the way it's handled, you know, where these kids go, where they end up. There's not a social services government presence as we know it in the U.S. Alexis, He has an aunt or two who live in the U.S., which, you know, might be very complicated for him. A lot of these kids, they'll end up either with neighbors in government, kind of wards of the state, or religious organizations that take care of these kids. And if they're lucky, they end up with family. And I actually met one girl. I was really curious to find out, where do these kids end up, but what impact does it have on you to spend your first 4, 5, or 6 formative years of your life in a prison? What impact does it have emotionally, psychologically, physically? That's really part of the big debate. And I met one girl who was born in prison. Her mother was a very high-profile drug cartel case. And essentially what happened is a distant cousin caught wind of, okay, this girl was born in prison, and he starts going to visit. His name is Jesus Buendia, and here he is talking about the first time he meets this baby who is in prison.
Yo la cargué porque se me hacía muy tierna.
Yeah, I lifted her up. I thought she was so sweet. And at the same time, I had a lot of questions, like, why is this kid in here? She got roll called like all the other inmates. She'd get up like all the inmates. They allowed her to go for walks like all the inmates. And that gave me this tenderness, and I just thought it was so strange.
Isabel's mom was facing the same exact problem as Alexis's mom. You know, Isabel was turning 4. Pretty soon, she was going to have to leave. This was a pretty rough prison. And she says to him one day, listen, my kid has nowhere to go. The whole family is on the inside. No one is going to take this kid. And, you know, Jesus thinks about it, and he decides to adopt baby Isabel.
Y su mamá se empezó a doler un poco, empezó a caer, y hablé con ella unas palabras. Le dije, mira.
And her mother was so sad, her face fell. And I said to her, listen, the way you feel right now, that's how I'm going to feel when you come back for her. So I'm asking you to be strong. If you're strong, I'll be strong. She took a deep breath. The prison authorities allowed her to accompany us as far as she could. And that's how this story begins.
That's how this story begins, Jasmine. Does it end with a happy ending for Isabel?
Well, yes and no. Isabel's 8 years old now. She's not like other 8-year-olds. When Jesus brought her home, pretty quick he realized she was not like other 4-year-olds.
No conocía un árbol.
She had never been close to a tree. She had never been close to other kids. She was the only kid at the prison. Food, she didn't know how to drink from a bottle or with a straw.
So she's not, when he brought her home, you know, when the exhilaration of having this new baby kind of faded away, the family realized, okay, there's some problems here. Not just, I mean, there's behavioral problems. He told me Isabel really, really gets upset when routines are broken. And he chalks that up to her having spent these formative years in prison. And there's also physical problems. Isabel had a stroke a couple of years ago. She's had just some physical problems. They've been working with specialists. But what Jesus told me is, at the end of the day, in between these crises, she's just the best thing that's ever happened to him.
Well, Jasmine, Isabel is a case of just one child, but she really is the picture of this debate, this dilemma, right, that you've uncovered in Mexico, a girl who got to spend a couple of years with her mom, but clearly has been affected adversely, clearly has been impacted negatively by a childhood behind bars.
Absolutely. Most experts I speak to on this topic tell me, you know, we're having this debate about what should happen to the kid. Should we have a prison nursery? Should the kid be allowed to stay, or should the kid be removed? And maybe we need to be having a debate about, you know, how militarized and ineffective the drug war has been in incarcerating, you know, women who were teenagers, or, you know, extremely harsh and long sentences, when really, you know, what we should be focusing is on drug treatment, drug courts. Why are these women getting involved? Are they being coerced into getting involved? Is the U.S. pumping over $2 billion into drug war enforcement in the last 10 years, is that where we need to be pumping our money into? Is it working?
Jasmine Garst, correspondent for the Across Women's Lives Project on Public Radio International. Jasmine, thank you so much for being here.
Thank you for having me.
And that's all for us today. Thanks so much for being with us this hour. I'm Todd Zwillich. This is The Takeaway.
A lot of us are not doing well.
First was March for Our Lives. Now young voices are speaking up at Town Hall for Our Lives.
What is being done to ensure that trauma-trained psychologists are available for every student?
The next chapter in a national movement against gun violence led by America's youth. That's next time on the Takeaway Podcast.
NYC Now delivers the most up-to-date local news from WNYC and Gothamist every morning, midday, and evening. With three updates a day, listeners get breaking news, top headlines, and in-depth coverage from across New York City. By sponsoring programming like NYC Now, you'll reach our community of dedicated listeners with premium messaging and an uncluttered audio experience. Visit sponsorship.wnyc.org to get in touch and find out more.